is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The root causes speak to governance failure, to elite-centric extractivism, which is not development, and triggers a rights violation. So this needs to be addressed.
That's Adriano Nuvunga, director of the Maputo-based Center for Democracy and Development, on expanding and lengthening the SADC military intervention in Mozambique. Details coming up. Also, U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, is stepping down. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control, John Nkengasong, has praised South Africa for the way it has handled the latest COVID-19 infection wave. Nkengasong, according to a Reuters report, said the government did not use lockdowns as a tool to combat the Omicron variant, and that using lockdowns as a method of controlling COVID is over. He suggested that health officials moving forward should use public health and social measures more carefully in a balanced way as vaccinations increase. Even for a South Africa that's become accustomed to corruption in the ruling party, revelations contained in documents of African National Congress meetings are shocking. They show how an ANC's cadre deployment committee decides appointments to top government positions. Details of the meetings have been obtained by the chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, the DA. Darren Taylor reports.
President Cyril Ramaphosa headed the ANC cadre deployment committee when he was Jacob Zuma's deputy for a few years before ousting Zuma in late 2017. The committee is based at ANC headquarters, Luthuli House in Johannesburg. The DA says the meeting minutes span the period from 2018 until last year, when the committee's been under the leadership of Deputy President David Mabuza.
What these minutes show is that the tentacles of cadre deployment has really spread throughout each and every part of our state.
Leon Schreibers, a DA Member of Parliament.
By our count, there were at least 96 different government departments or agencies or state-owned enterprises where the cadre deployment committee interfered in the appointment process during this three-year period. Likely from municipal level up all the way through to our constitutional court, there's not a single state institution that has not been affected by a small committee within the ANC that sits literally in offices in Luthuli House and decides who gets appointed to positions of power in the state.
The ANC insists there's nothing wrong with this. It's done by ruling parties everywhere. They just don't call it cadre deployment. But Schreiber says such committees with untrammeled power are common only in autocratic states.
We can see that ministers and even the president being admonished if they dare to make an appointment outside of the scope of the cadre deployment committee.
In the minutes of one particular meeting, there's an item titled Applications for Deployment.
People are possibly sending their CVs or directing requests to be deployed directly to the ANC's cadre deployment committee rather than to the competent entity within the state. And you'll see in the minutes things like Comrade Supra is available for international deployment, whereby apparently a senior ANC official has applied to the deployment committee to become an ambassador. This is really, really staggering evidence of how an entire parallel appointment process has been built that circumvents the state completely.
The minutes show the committee giving management posts in municipalities, for example, not to skilled service delivery experts, but sometimes to ANC members without high school education. The DA blames the ANC's cadre deployment policy for widespread service delivery failures. The ANC maintains it's committed to appointing people based on their skills, academic credentials, and experience, not party membership. But Schreiber says the minutes show power and the money that comes with it is everything to the ANC.
Loyalty to the ANC and its ideological project or its ability to milk the state for its own benefit is the deciding factor in who gets appointed in many of these positions. At one point, while discussing which cadre should run entities like Rand Water, there's an offhand comment in the minutes that Jagersfontein in the Free State doesn't have water. But apparently the ANC doesn't see the irony in discussing which cadre will manage this entity, even as there is already no water anymore.
In South Africa, the Judicial Services Commission, the JSC, is supposed to decide who gets appointed as judges. During the period covered by the minutes, says Schreiber, there were 8 vacancies at court divisions.
In every single case, the person was recommended by the ANC Cadre Deployment Committee long before the JSC had made a decision, was appointed as a judge. That should raise very, very serious red flags about the interference of a political party in the judiciary of South Africa.
The ANC says it's studying the minutes and will explain them soon. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
U.S. Special Envoy to the Horn of Africa, Jeffrey Feltman, is stepping down this month after more than 9 months on the job. According to a Reuters report, outgoing ambassador to Turkey, David Satterfield, will replace Feltman. The news of Feltman's departure comes before he meets senior Ethiopian officials in the capital Addis Ababa today as part of Washington's latest push to bring an end to the country's conflict. Feltman, according to Wire reports, has faced strong headwinds to progress in the past few months. The year-long war in Ethiopia's Tigray region and Sudan's military coup are two examples. Satterfield is a veteran of the U.S. Foreign Service with more than 4 decades of experience. Prior to Ankara, his postings include Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, Tunisia, and Syria. After Ethiopia's embattled prime minister pulled off a stunning military victory earlier this month, reversing a rebel march in the capital that threatened to overthrow him, he credited the bravery of his troops. In reality, a critical reason for the reversal in Abiy's fortune was hovering in the skies above. Over the past 4 months, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, and Iran have quietly supplied Abiy with some of the latest armed drones. The demonstration of drone power confirmed that Ethiopia's year-old conflict, largely a regional affair until now, has been internationalized, and it adds the country to a growing list of conventional conflicts. Angie Omar spoke to David DeRoche, associate professor at National Defense University.
The conventional analysis tends to be very equipment-centric, and so people tend to, and this is a tendency throughout warfare, people look at a new innovation and say, this was decisive. You know, in 1940, it was the tank that made Hitler's achievements in Western Europe possible. In actuality, they are critical, but not as decisive as people let on. So what you've seen is whenever new technology is introduced, in this instance, a cheap, affordable air power, particularly against untrained troops like the Tigrayan rebels, it does create a deal of panic. And if forces aren't trained to react to it, it can have a very, very big effect. But, you know, it usually has to be integrated into other things like a fire support system and sustained logistics. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, it's less visible, but I think that UAE support for Ethiopian forces would probably have also extended to helping them sustain their involvement, you know, and that's important as well. But clearly what we're seeing is an era when even relatively medium and small powers like Ethiopia now have the ability to have a persistent aerial observation and attack capability. That is a new increase in warfare, and it is going to be important, particularly against relatively untrained troops.
In a letter to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Tigray leader Debretsion Gebremichael called for a ceasefire followed by peace talks. On Monday, his spokesman said that a wave of Ethiopian airstrikes inside Tigray had killed 18 civilians and wounded 11. An Ethiopian government spokesman UN did not respond to questions about the use of drones. Could the use of drones put an end to the year-long conflict in Ethiopia?
Not by themselves, but they certainly, as part of an overall military campaign, they can. So, you know, when you hear about airstrikes, it's very hard to disaggregate what was an airstrike with conventional aircraft, which delivers a much bigger cargo, a much bigger bomb, or a drone strike. A lot of times, if drones are known to be used on the battlefield, every airstrike will be reported as a drone strike. This is very common, for example, with the American war against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. But in actuality, you know, we've seen this in analysis of the Armenia-Azerbaijan war. Pretty much every strike was reported as a drone strike, and a lot of them were conventional missiles, conventional artillery, or drones. So, you know, this is part of an overall military campaign. But for drones to be really effective, they have to be integrated in with a conventional fire support plan and integrated in with a conventional military plan. Absent that, you have the possibility of occasional disruptive attacks, but drones by themselves are not decisive on the battlefield. And I think that when all is known, Ethiopian war, what we'll find out is that where they've been successful, the drones have been one element of a pretty effectively integrated ground attack campaign, where drones have provided additional fire support, and they've provided, even more importantly, reconnaissance and intelligence.
The Emirati drone strikes in Ethiopian war under the direction of National Security Advisor Tahnoon bin Zayed Al Nahyan appeared to be a snub to American diplomatic efforts to end the war. American officials say they are trying to draw the UAE into peace efforts as an ally, but that cooperation is limited. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair statement. I mean, the Emiratis in the last few years have basically been, they've adopted the position that the United States has interests in the region, but those interests can change, and the United States is in a position where it can leave the region, whereas the Emiratis live in the region, and they know what their interests are, and only they can, you know, they can only rely on themselves to protect their interests. So they will cooperate with the United States when they can, when they think that the American view coincides with their own, but they have been very patiently building up the capability to act unilaterally. They don't want to offend or to be in direct confrontation with the United States, but I think they quite rightly assess that anything that happens in Africa is of secondary importance to the United States, but it's of greater importance to themselves. And so they're going to act as they see fit. And they've been building up the capability to do that over a period of years.
That was David DeRoche, Associate Professor at National Defense University, speaking with reporter Angie Omar. The Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS, has been pushing Mali's military government to allow elections by February. This week, the grouping sent a mediator, former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, to deliver a message ahead of a summit on Mali, which experienced a coup last May. Coup leaders recently announced a plan for a five-year transition to democracy. Annie Risenberg reports from Bamako.
Goodluck Jonathan was in Mali to meet with Mali's transitional leaders, including President Assimi Goïta, ahead of an ECOWAS summit on Mali, which will be held this Sunday in Ghana. President Goïta and the ECOWAS delegation spent almost 2 hours talking at Mali's presidential palace. Jonathan briefly addressed the press but did not disclose the contents of Wednesday's meeting.
The key thing is that we've been properly briefed and we have conveyed that to the authorities of heads of states and government of the ECOWAS community. I think that is what we can tell you now.
ECOWAS has been pressuring Mali's military government to hold elections in February. This past December, military leaders submitted a five-year plan to ECOWAS, which proposes the next presidential election be held in 2026. ECOWAS has already imposed financial and travel sanctions on members of Mali's military government and threatens further penalties if the February election deadline is not met. Fuseni Diop, Civic Engagement Program Manager at AJCAD, the Youth Association for Active Citizenship and Democracy, says that if further sanctions are economic, it could be devastating for the Malian population. He says, if ECOWAS doesn't take its responsibility, he thinks that this will be a precedent. He says another coup d'etat already happened in Guinea. He says this would mean that today we can come to power without going through the ballot box, and that means that we will continue with perpetual coups, and this will encourage other groups who will wait 1 year or 2 years to overturn those in power, because they know that at the end of the day, nothing will be done. A coup in Guinea last September led to the ouster of that nation's president, Alpha Condé. Khalilu Sidibe, professor of political science and international relations at the University of Bamako, says that ECOWAS and Mali's transitional leaders are likely to come to an agreement on a future presidential election date, one much sooner than the 2026 elections proposed by the military. He says if ECOWAS stands firm in its position to organize elections no later than February 27, 2022, the crisis could continue and the Malian government will take action. He says he doesn't think Mali is going in that direction. He says ECOWAS will maybe tell transitional leaders that they can grant a timeline of 8 months beyond February, at which point they should organize elections. Both Diop and Sidibe affirmed that ECOWAS has protocols in place for a coup, and that further action against Mali's leaders should be expected if they cannot work with ECOWAS to agree on a timeline for a return to civilian rule. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
The South African Development Community has postponed a special summit to review the progress of SADC's military intervention in Mozambique. Planned for tomorrow, it is now scheduled for next Tuesday. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
The postponement comes after President Mokgweetsi Masisi tested positive for COVID-19 this week. As the chairperson for SADC's organ on politics, defense and security, Masisi played a key role in the deployment of hundreds of troops to fight insurgents in Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado region. In October, SADC agreed to indefinitely extend the troop stay in Mozambique. Civic organizations, including Maputo-based Center for Democracy and Development, CDD, wants SADC to extend and expand their presence. CDD Director Adriano Nuvunga says while there is progress, insurgents remain a threat.
There is a need, therefore, to expand the mandate of SAMI, give them a bit more of stability, and the member states should fundraise to make sure that there is funding to sustain the mission in Mozambique, which in our view should not be a short, but minimum a mid-term deployment.
Nuvunga adds that the SADC mission is key to the process of opening dialogue.
It's to supporting the dialogue in addressing the issues that have to do or speak to the root causes of the problem. Because as we have talked a number of times in the past, the root causes speak to governance failures, to elite-centric extractivism, which is not developmental, and triggers rights violations. So this needs to be addressed, and SAMIM can also be instrumental there in facilitating some of those avenues for dialogue.
While SADC is trying to find a solution in Mozambique, another troubled spot, Eswatini, has been omitted from the summit's agenda. Lucky Lukele, spokesperson for Swaziland Solidarity Network, says they remain hopeful SADC will address Eswatini's challenges.
We have noted the urgent SADC meeting, and we also note that there seems to be one item on the agenda, the Mozambican question. We are still hopeful that SADC will approach this thing differently, like the first time that they did under the Botswana chairperson of Troika. The South African-led process by President Cyril Ramaphosa through his envoy, Mr. Jeff Hadebe, seems to be credible. We have no reason to question it for now.
Last year, Eswatini, led by Africa's remaining absolute monarch, was rocked by deadly pro-democracy protests with demands for constitutional reforms. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habrone, Botswana.
Tunisia's powerful General Labour Union has criticized President Kais Saied's roadmap out of the country's political crisis, saying setting a date for elections is an important step to end the exceptional situation, but it does not break with individual rule and exclusion. Saied announced a plan to move past the political crisis that has the country paralyzed since Saied suspended parliament, dismissed the prime minister, and assumed executive authority last year. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi possible scenarios to get out of the crisis.
It's going to have to be, like we saw in Libya to some degree, a combination of actions on the ground between pro-democracy forces and international pressure in support of that. And so far, we've had not enough of either. The transitology literature says that we need, you know, an alliance between business and labor for things to move forward in democratic transitions. However, we had that in Tunisia. It was called the Carthage Pact, and it kept democracy on track from 2013 to 2019, when President Essebsi died. In fact, the Tunisians even won a Nobel Prize for it, the famous quartet. That was a pacted transition between business and labor and other elements of society in favor of democracy. What changed? Essebsi died, and then the COVID economic crisis hit, and Saied took advantage of the situation to take over all powers of government and then get the backing of anti-democratic Arab autocrats like Sisi in Egypt, like Tebboune in Algeria, and to a lesser degree, MBS and MBZ from Saudi Arabia and UAE. The old contract in politics from autocrats was, we give you economic benefits and you, the population, stay out of politics. But this fails in the long run. It caused the Arab Spring. It caused the Arab Spring 2.0 in Algeria, Sudan, Lebanon, and Iraq. We have periodic unrest in the region. We will have more unrest in Tunisia since they're not addressing the economics. And when the crowds get big enough, and the political forces ally with the crowds, then that is the beginning of the end of any autocrat in the region, and in this case, Kais Saied. Sometimes you'll have palace coups, and the regime will replace the unpopular leader with another leader, as we've seen in many countries, rather than a democratic opening. Democratic openings are much harder. But one thing's for sure, that this is not the end of democracy in Tunisia, that the long-term win will be for, I believe, the Arab Spring forces. You know, the Arab Spring and its offspring will prevail, but it's going to take larger crowds in the streets calling for Saied's dismissal and international forces tamping down on support of Arab autocrats for him.
Some analysts say that if the Tunisian leaders fail to create a new democratic bargain, every autocrat in the Middle East and North Africa will point to Tunisia's failure to argue for maintaining one version or another of the old authoritarian compact. Do you agree with that?
Not at all, because the Carthage Pact succeeded for 6 years. It just fell apart because of the factors that I mentioned. The COVID economic crisis, creating a set of socioeconomic grievances which toppled the leader, and that can happen to a democratic leader or an Arab autocrat. Those grievances were real, and those grievances caused the situation currently more than anything else. And what the Arab autocrats are offering doesn't work in the long run. What works in the long run is enough socioeconomic benefits distributed to the population to quiet down the socioeconomic protests, and enough political rights distributed to the population that they feel that they're influencing what the government's doing, even if it's not a full democracy. And in this case, Saied is giving them neither. He's giving them no economic reform and no political reform with any meaning in it. And so to whatever degree this is the old authoritarian compact, it's failing.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Despite heightened security, the closures of main streets and internet and mobile service interruptions, thousands of Sudanese demonstrated in Khartoum and other cities today to protest against the military, which led a coup more than 2 months ago. The protests come 4 days after Abdullah Hamdok resigned as prime minister, throwing Sudan's future deeper into uncertainty. In his resignation speech, Hamdok warned that Sudan was at a dangerous crossroads, threatening its very survival. Just last Tuesday, the United States, European Union, Britain, and Norway warned Sudan's military leaders against naming their own successor to Hamdok, saying they would not support a prime minister or government appointed without the involvement of a broad range of civilian stakeholders. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mobilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.